This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Hey, listeners, thanks for dropping in. I'm Christy.
And I'm Melissa, and this is Buried Motives, where we dig deep into the details of some of the most gruesome
dirtbag murderers.
Hey, listeners.
Welcome back to Buried Motives.
We are glad you're joining us this week, and I am excited to hear Christy's case. She's been telling me just little pieces about it, and it sounds like it's going to be a wild ride.
I'm actually so excited to tell this case today. And I'm going to admit right off the bat that I chose this case for the most unusual reason. I was doing some other research, and I just so happened to see this woman's name in a list of murderers on the side of the page that I was on. I read her name and I thought to myself, ooh, with a name like that, I have to know her story. I just knew it was going to be juicy.
What's her name?
Well, I'll tell you. Once I took a look, I knew she would be my next case. I guess you could say she found me, but hopefully not really, because I don't have time to be haunted by a ghostly dirtbag.
No, we've had those experiences already.
Yeah, it was by chance for sure that I came across it. This woman was described as being Texas's Black Widow. I feel like it has been a while since we covered a Black Widow. So just a little shout out to Melissa's episode on Belle Gunness way back when we just started our podcast. We have covered a few more after that, but it was definitely time for another.
And Texas does seem to be a favorite of ours.
We love Texas. A Black Widow woman typically means a woman who kills her lovers. In the animal kingdom, a female Black Widow spider will often devour her mate if he is smaller than she is after mating. She gets what she needs from him and then gets rid of him. Sad that this can essentially happen with people as well.
I never want to admit it, but I do find it fascinating.
It is fascinating. I also thought that this case was timely. Last time I covered a case in California for our most listened from state. And now I'm covering a case that took place in Texas for our second most listened from state.
Sorry. That's exactly why I looked in Texas for my case.
Really? Yeah. Well, Texas, you're getting double the love.
Now there's no excuse that you don't take over that number one spot.
That's right. Come on, Texas. But again, shout out to all of our listeners. We appreciate you wherever you are in the globe. So this name. The name of the woman who grabbed my attention is Betty Lou Beats. Isn't that a fantastic name?
Betty Lou Beats?
Yes.
Like beets as the vegetable?
Yes. I don't know why, but to me it sounded like the name of an actress from the 60s. Or the imagined tough, blonde, big-haired aunt that could have worked on Schrute Farms from The Office.
That's hilarious.
Her younger pictures looked exactly the way that I thought that they would. I will be sure to post one on our social medias. But I don't know why I fell in love with her name. Surprisingly, there is not a lot of coverage for this case. I was able to find plenty of court documents, but not a lot of media reports. She is referred to as Betty Lou in some, as well as Betty in others. I think she was called Betty Lou by those who knew her, so that is what I will call her. As we often see in the cases that we cover here on Buried Motives, Betty Lou did not have a wholesome or safe childhood. She had to grow up pretty quickly. Betty Lou Beats was born Betty Lou Dunavant on March 12, 1937, in Roxborough, Person County, North Carolina. Betty Lou's father was James, or Jimmy, Garland Dunavant. He was also born in North Carolina and came from a large family. I counted 7 siblings on Find a Grave. Jimmy worked for NASA as a machinist and served in the USCC camps. And I believe this is the Civilian Conservation Corps, or CCC, which was a work relief program that gave young men jobs to do during the Great Depression. This was spearheaded by Roosevelt, and the men in this program would be hired to do things like plant trees and construct trails and shelters, essentially helping to shape many of the United States state parks. I read that during this time, they planted over 3 billion trees.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So her dad was a part of that.
It's pretty awesome.
Yeah, I learned something new. Betty Lou's mother was Margaret Louise Smithwick. She, too, was born in North Carolina. I couldn't find as much about her background, other than that she went by her middle name, Louise. Louise and Jimmy had 4 children in total. 2 boys, James and Dewey, and 2 girls, Jackie and Betty Lou. I'll just note that James and Jackie may still be living. Betty Lou's parents have since passed away, as well as her brother Dewey, who went by the nickname Punchy. He died at the age of 47.
That's quite the nickname.
I know. Everyone in this case seems to have a nickname or went by a different name.
So you've got Punchy and then Mrs. Beats. Gonna yep. beat you down.
Right? Punchy Beats. Well, no, he wasn't Beats. Dewey passed away not knowing who his sister really was, but Louise and Jimmy died knowing that their daughter was a killer. They were buried side by side with their gravestone inscription reading, "Together forever, married 59 years, we all love you." This may sound all cute, but when Betty Lou was young, her life with her parents was anything but cute and lovey. When Betty Lou was born, her parents were working as sharecroppers on a tobacco farm and already had a 2-year-old son. To say that they lived in poverty would be an understatement. They lived in what was essentially a shack on the property. They had no running water, no electricity, and they didn't even have glass in their windows. I imagine they spent more than one night going to bed hungry and shivering. To make matters worse, it was said that Betty Lou's father, Jimmy, was not very kind and was abusive towards his family. When Betty Lou was still fairly young, I think around the age of 3, her family moved from North Carolina to Hampton, Virginia. Both parents worked in the cotton mills. Jimmy later got a job as a machinist at the Langley Research Center. This new job did slowly begin to help out their financial situation, but it took a while. Soon after moving to Virginia, Betty Lou came down with a severe case of the measles. She spent days running a temperature of 105 degrees Fahrenheit. It was said that her parents did not expect her to live.
Did they think she had brain damage from the fever?
Possibly, but she did have a more visual effect from it. Betty Lou did survive, but because of her extended fever, she became hearing impaired, a condition that would only worsen for her later in life.
That's common with measles.
Mm-hmm. Perhaps because of her difficulty hearing, Betty Lou did not do well academically in school. She said she was hearing impaired and learning disabled without any help. As a child, Betty Lou taught herself to lip read. If she couldn't see people's facial cues or if they weren't facing her, she didn't really know what was going on. Unbelievably, Betty Lou wouldn't get hearing aids until she was around 40 years old. She said it was the first time she could hear things like water, the wind, the rain, birds, and other things like clocks. She also said she was surprised that certain things even made a noise, like a toaster, your clothes, or when you walk across a carpet.
Oh, interesting.
Mm-hmm.
I actually love watching those videos when they do the little kids and they put their cochlear implants in for the first time and they hear.
Yes. Just those little things that we take for granted, that your pants swishing against yourself is going to make a noise. For some of us, it makes more noise than others. Needless to say, though, as a child, Betty Lou struggled and had to repeat grade 4. Sadly, the kids at school were mean. She was said to be an outcast without any friends. The only real interaction she got from other children at school was when they were bullying her. When Betty Lou turned 12, her mother was admitted into a mental health hospital for a few months. This would be extra hard on Betty Lou. The responsibility of taking care of her younger brother, who was 5, and sister, who was 3, now fell onto her. I believe Dewey was 2 years older than her, and Jackie and James were the younger ones. This would have been in 1949, when a boy or even a father wouldn't have likely been expected to help out very much domestically. So Betty Lou was pulled from school for a time to tend to the house and her siblings.
That would have been so difficult. And to really not even understand what was going on. Because I doubt it was explained to her why her mother had even went into the hospital.
No, it doesn't sound like it was. Betty Lou did give an account of this and just said she knew her mom had been sick off and on leading up to it. And then her mom was just gone for a few months. And everything fell on her. Betty Lou's mother would sometimes come home on the weekends to visit. And so Betty Lou would make sure that food was cooked and the house was clean. Other family members would come to visit her mother on these weekends. Betty Lou recalls everyone messing up the house, eating the food, and leaving her no time to visit with her mom before she would have to go back to the hospital.
Oh, and then she'd just be left to clean up the mess after everyone left?
Yes.
And these were adults that were coming to visit her mom?
Yeah, they were just all visiting and eating. And so Betty Lou would spend like the week getting ready for her mom to come home, hoping to spend time with her. extended family would come over, kind of overtake the time, and then her mom would go back to the hospital and Betty Lou would be left to do it all over again.
It is hard to imagine another woman doing that, not want to help Betty Lou out, to see the situation as it was and not like an aunt or a grandmother or a friend coming over and wanting to help.
Right. But when they got there, the house was clean, the food was cooked. They're thinking, oh, they're doing okay. And they're just focusing on Louise, on Betty Lou's mom. It was pretty sad.
But that's also Betty Lou's view of the situation, too.
Yes. Perhaps from the increased stress, Betty Lou's father's drinking began to increase. With this increase in alcohol consumption came the escalation of abuse towards Betty Lou, and I would assume the other children. Betty Lou said that her father sexually abused her starting at the age of 5. I imagine the frequency of that would have increased as well with her mother being gone. And Betty Lou said that her father wasn't the only one to sexually abuse her. There were others who were close to her that did so as well.
Friends or family members?
She didn't really say who. And I didn't put this in here, but she had talked about how she hated bath time and, you know, different situations where this kind of thing would happen. So it could have been an uncle, I don't know, just other people that were close enough to her to have access to her and starting at age 5, which is really heartbreaking. Understandably, Betty Lou would have been looking for the fastest way to get out of Dodge as soon as she could have. At age 15, 1 month after completing grade 9, she found just that, a way to escape her horrible childhood. And I believe that she finished grade 10, but then dropped out of school for good. At 15 years old, in 1952, Betty Lou would get married for the first time. She married a man named Robert Franklin Branson. Betty Lou later said that she loved Robert dearly, and I think he was perhaps the only one that she truly did love. A year into her marriage with Robert, Betty Lou claimed that he began abusing her. The couple separated. Betty Lou took this separation hard and made an attempt at taking her own life. The couple reconciled after this and got back together.
Was the separation her idea?
I don't think so. Despite the abuse allegation, Betty Lou and Robert ended up staying together for 18 years, minus their little separation period. They called it quits in 1969. Betty Lou said that when Robert left her at the age of 31, she had to figure out how to live without him. In her words, she was uneducated and didn't have any skills per se that she could fall back on. Betty Lou admitted that she started to drink after her husband left. She said she would get her oldest daughter to babysit and go out to hide from the kids.
How many kids did she have?
At this point, 5.
Oh, wow.
She said she would go out into the world where her ex-husband was and drink herself to sleep. So she wasn't coping well. After this first marriage, we can see a clear pattern emerge. A pattern where it seems like Betty Lou always needed to be in a relationship. She would go on to marry not just one more guy after Robert. She would marry 4 more. And one of them twice.
So she had 5 more marriages after her first?
Yes. So 6 marriages to 5 men in total.
I wonder if serial marriages is kind of like the years in a marriage. And how the first one is like the honeymoon phase, but then they just keep getting worse after that.
Oh, maybe.
Not that it gets worse in your marriage every year.
But... Well, I was thinking back to our 7-year itch collaboration. Yeah, you never know. Mind you, her last marriage might have been one of her best ones.
Okay.
Betty Lou would have 6 children in total throughout these marriages. And at some point, I think fairly early on, she settled in Texas. Betty said that she had 6 children with Robert, but I did read one account that 5 were from him and 1 was not. But don't quote me on that. But I kind of believe that.
And it sounds like she might have went through these men quite quickly if she was already 31 when she left her first husband.
Right.
Well, even if she's, say she's 60, that's still only 30 years for 5 more husbands, 5 more marriages.
Oh, we get through 5 more marriages way quicker than that.
Oh, really?
Yes. And that actually leads me into what I wanted to talk about next. First of all, I'm going to say no judgment. But I did decide to look into this phenomenon of always needing to be in a relationship because she didn't wait very long in between marriages. And it was an interesting rabbit hole. So I am taking you all down this hole with me for a minute.
So she just always needed a man beside her.
Always. I found an article on the Harley Therapy Mental Health blog that gave 9 reasons why someone might repeatedly rush into relationships. I'm going to very briefly share these reasons Again, not to judge, but just to give us some understanding of this behavior, because I think more than one of these can apply to Betty Lou. And I will say that not all of these things may be accurate for everyone, so don't come after me if you tend to fall into this category. First, you could be codependent. You find your own self-worth by pleasing others, and often choose someone who you need to quote-unquote fix. An example of this would be dating someone with an addiction, thinking you can save them. Second, on the flip side of reason one, you could be counter-dependent. This type of person actually fears real intimacy. This can make you possessive and demanding and cause you to try to force things along. Third, you might have an anxious attachment style. I think this one definitely applies to Betty Lou. It basically suggests that in order to grow into an adult with healthy relating styles, you need to have a reliable connection or attachment with a caregiver as a child. This may cause you to fear rejection and abandonment, so you jump in with both feet way too soon. The fourth idea I think also applies to Betty Lou. It consists of having a core belief that you have to earn love. As a child, the love from your caregiver had strings attached, and so as an adult, you can get sucked into a relationship faster than you are ready for by trying to earn love. Fifth, you lack boundaries. This means that you have a hard time saying no to other people. You have no limits with your relationship, which can result in you becoming panicked or resentful afterwards. Reason number six alludes to not really knowing who you are as a person or having a damaged sense of self-worth. This definitely would apply to Betty Lou. She didn't really get to be a kid. She was bullied and abused and turned into a caregiver before she was even a teenager. This category is common for people who had traumatic childhoods. Number seven is having ADHD or borderline personality disorder as an adult. ADHD may mean you make decisions quickly without thinking them through completely, and borderline personality disorder can cause you to feel things intensely, and you might rush into a relationship to try and feel safe and avoid rejection. Eighth is having an addictive personality. You can actually get addicted to that in love feeling. It gives you a high, so to speak, so you chase after it.
Twitter-pated.
Yes. And finally, ninth, you don't have an understanding of what a healthy relationship is. You never really saw or learned what happens in a good relationship. You could have a skewed perspective of what is acceptable, or you could romanticize the idea of love.
So many of those deal with the attachment bonds you make as a child and how you navigate and understand them.
It's so important. What happens in our childhoods? And we don't often make that connection when we're watching someone in a relationship later.
No, it's hard to see a spouse or a partner as a child.
Yeah. But I did see you nodding your head a few times as I was reading these out. As a nurse, do you feel like these are pretty accurate?
Yeah, but I think that they all stem down to attachment.
Right. So different types of attachment disorders.
Most of them stem down to attachment.
Okay. I just thought it was interesting because as we're going to be talking about Betty Lou and her upcoming marriages, it will maybe give us some understanding as to why this woman was doing what she was doing.
So she doesn't kill them all?
No.
Oh. Well, you said she was a black widow, so I was thinking she was going to tick off the husbands.
Oh, no. Just wait. We are in for a wild ride, but no, she doesn't kill all of her husbands. Within a year after her marriage ended with Robert, Betty Lou married for the second time to a man named Billy York Lane. So this includes the courting time.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, how cute would they have been as Betty Lou and Billy? I have a thing with names. I don't know.
But you also said that she was drinking a lot at this time. So I'm sure that that hastened her decision making.
Could be. And sadly, their relationship was anything but cute. They were married in 1970 and divorced the same year. This marriage didn't end because of tiffs over whose turn it was to do the dishes or how much money the other one was spending. Their marriage didn't work out because they both admittedly threatened the other one's life.
Probably best that they got divorced.
Yeah, but just wait. We're not done. Betty Lou would find herself in abusive relationships, but she knew how to dish it as well. If you played with this firecracker, you were sure to be burned. In one particular argument, Billy struck Betty Lou so hard that it broke her nose. Betty Lou wasn't having it, and so in retaliation, she pulled out her gun and she shot Billy twice in the side of his abdomen, entering through his back.
What?
Yeah, she shot him twice. You're going to break my nose? I'm going to teach you a lesson.
Can you just imagine what the police would be like when they were called to that incident?
No.
Like trying to get the story about who did what to who and which one do you arrest?
I know. She had a broken nose. He
Yeah, gunshot wounds.
Yeah, his was attempted murder. Yeah. There's a little bit of a difference in the escalation there. Miraculously, Billy survived this brutal attack. Betty Lou was charged with attempted murder, but the charges were later dropped at the request of Billy. Betty Lou instead was allowed to plead guilty to a misdemeanor assault. Billy said that he had threatened her life first, so he didn't really blame her for shooting him.
Well, that was decent of him.
Yeah.
What?
Right? He's actually not that decent of a guy. But despite the shooting, the couple couldn't stay away from one another, and so they remarried in 1972.
They were still Twitter baited.
They were on again, off again this whole time. Sadly, it turned out that the second time wouldn't be the charm, and their second marriage also wouldn't last very long.
6 months, right?
1 month.
Oh!
They called it quits for good just 1 month later.
Okay, from time of meeting to time of calling it quits the second time, was it 18 months?
2 years. Well, It might have been because it was sometime in 1970, and I'm not sure exactly when, but they were married and divorced in 1970, remarried in 1972, but carried on the relationship in between that time, and then a month later in 1972, they were divorced again.
I'm telling you, 18 months is like a magic number for Twitter baited.
And it could have been, because it would fit in the time frame, that 18 months.
Mm-hmm.
It was hard for me to find the dates of the marriages, but I could find the years. Thankfully, they did decide to split before actually killing each other. This part of the case reminded me of the case that Love, Mary, Kill told us about in our Broken Hearts collaboration that was released on Valentine's Day. They told us about a case where the wife shot the husband, but he forgave her, and they stayed together afterwards. Betty Lou and Billy didn't stay together, but it is remarkable to me that he didn't want to even press charges.
Well, he went back to her and married her again.
Yes, I couldn't get over that he married her a second time. How could you ever relax knowing that your spouse has what it takes to actually pull the trigger? Like, if I got lippy, I would be scared.
Oh, leave him with one eye open.
Exactly. This was just wild to me that this is real life for some people. The next year, Betty Lou started dating the man who would become her third husband, Ronnie Charles Threlkeld. Because he was rarely seen without his boots and cowboy hat on, most of his family and friends called him Cowboy. 5 years after dating, they got married in 1978. Again, this relationship was tumultuous, and they divorced the following year in 1979. The tumultuousness of this relationship is proven by Betty Lou's actions that caused them to decide to split. In a fit of rage, Betty Lou tried to run over Ronnie with her car.
Murder weapon number two.
Yes, second attempt. Again, thankfully, he survived, but the relationship was definitely over. And just a little side note, I found Ronnie's memorial write-up, and it looks like he did go on to remarry and had a beautiful life. Both Ronnie and Billy would later testify at Betty Lou's murder trial. These two incidents would not help her future case.
No kidding.
We're on marriage four, three men, two attempted murders.
Okay. She just seems volatile.
Extremely volatile. Husband number four and wedding number five was to a man named Doyle Wayne Barker, who went by his middle name of Wayne. They wed the same year that she split from Ronnie. She wasted no time. So in 1979. And I was thinking, were divorce proceedings much faster back in the 70s? Because how do you get divorced and married in the same year multiple times?
Must have been faster.
Or maybe they had less of them to process back then?
Nobody was contesting them if they were trying to kill each other.
True. This marriage lasted for 2 years until August of 1981, when Wayne just took off.
He had had enough of her?
Yeah. The following year, in 1982, Betty Lou would marry her fifth and final husband, Jimmy Don Beats. Jimmy Don was a fire department captain, and this marriage would also only last for about a year. At this point, she was living in Henderson County, Texas, near Cedar Creek Lake, called Gun Barrel City, which is in eastern Texas, I believe.
That is an awesome name for a city.
Right?
Gun Barrel?
Yeah. Very fitting for Betty Lou. Betty Lou would say that her relationship with Jimmy Don was abusive, like most of the other ones in her past, but this is debated. I actually don't think it was, or not to the degree, at least, that she is saying. On August 6th of 1983, Betty Lou Beats reported her husband missing. An investigation was launched, and Jimmy's boat was found floating near the Redwood Beach Marina on Cedar Creek Lake 6 days after he was reported missing on August 12th. Upon inspection of his fishing boat, authorities discovered his fishing license, his heart medication, nitroglycerin, and his life jacket. Police believe that Jimmy Don had been out fishing and somehow fell into the water and drowned. Some of the pills were scattered on the floor of the boat, so they assume that maybe he was having a heart attack, and in the commotion of trying to take his nitroglycerin, he fell into the water.
Okay, that's all sounding pretty believable.
Right?
It's a good story.
It is, because he did have heart complications.
And nobody wears their life jacket, or very few people wear their life jacket while they're boating.
Especially when you're a seasoned fisherman.
Yeah.
He did it all the time. Rescue crews tirelessly searched the water for 3 weeks, but could not find his body. It was said that because Jimmy Don was employed by the City of Dallas Fire Department for 26 years and had relationships with other first responders, the search for him was extensive. They just weren't looking in the right spot. It would take 2 years for everyone to finally know for sure what happened to Jimmy. 2 years of everyone feeling sorry for Betty Lou and her rotten luck with men, mourning with the woman whose husband died in a tragic accident. Imagine their surprise when the truth would finally come out.
They would feel so betrayed.
You really would. Even just as a neighbor who kind of knows her, you would be like, what the heck?
Well, because you would feel so sorry for her.
Right. Yeah, it would be, like you said, a betrayal. And she almost got away with it. In mid-1985, police received a reliable tip via Crime Stoppers about the disappearance of Jimmy Don Beats. Because of the things this tipster told them, police knew that they had to interview some of Betty Lou's children. Upon questioning, Robert, or Robbie Branson Jr., Betty Lou's adult son from her first marriage, told police that one day in August of 1983, Betty Lou told him to leave the house because she was going to kill Jimmy. And so Robbie just left the house.
Oh, he didn't raise an eyebrow. He didn't question why. Or what are you thinking?
I don't think he thought she was actually going to do it. She was so volatile, maybe it meant she was just going to take it out on him, but was like, you need to get out of here. I'm going to kill him. Robbie was on probation for a felony burglary charge, and so he was living with his mother and Jimmy Don at the time. Robbie said about his mother, quote, she said she wanted me to leave and she didn't want me to be around when she shot and killed him. He said that he came back 2 hours later and discovered that his mother had actually killed her husband, Jimmy Don Beats. She had shot him twice with a .38 caliber handgun. He was lying dead on the floor.
Why didn't he go to the police?
Well, because Betty Lou told her son that he needed to help her get rid of the body. And he complied because he wanted to protect his mother.
Okay.
You know how people joke, like, who would you call if you had a body to hide? Well, she enlisted her son.
Robbie Jr. was her go-to.
Right. Just previous to this, Betty Lou had Jimmy Don and her son Robbie build her a wishing well in the front yard of their Texas rural mobile home. Betty Lou and Robbie dropped Jimmy's body inside of this wishing well and covered him over.
They actually dug like a hole in the wishing well. It wasn't like just one of those wooden ones that you place on top of the ground.
No, she had her husband and her son build an actual well. I don't know if she was going to put a pond in there or what she was doing, but she had him dig it in.
Did she have them dig it 6 feet?
Well, it was big enough to put him in there. So I think she knew ahead of time that this is where she was going to put his body.
Yeah, because usually you just put those little like ornamental wishing well things just on top of the ground. This totally speaks premeditation.
Oh, totally. And it looked like that from the outside. It did look like one of just those ornamental little wells on the top. But she had had the boys dig it down, like dig out the dirt. And so they threw his body in there and packed it back up with dirt.
I can't even wrap my head around what kind of excuse she would have had to give them to, here, dig this hole for me.
Whatever it was, they weren't suspicious about it.
They actually thought it was a wishing well?
Yeah. She was going to make it into a little well. Jimmy Don had no idea, just days prior, that when he was digging into the ground for the decorative well for his wife, he was essentially digging his own grave. I don't know why, but this fact really bothered me. He was doing a service for his wife, likely thinking about how happy it was going to make her, just to be stuffed inside of it and left there for 2 years. She would have looked at that wishing well in her front yard every single day and knew Jimmy Don was inside. She would have walked past it 100 times. Also, I was thinking that with it being a new feature to her yard, did friends and neighbors compliment her on her fancy new ornamental piece?
Oh, I'm sure she played it up because it was the last thing Jimmy Don built her.
Oh, I'm sure she did because Betty went ahead and planted flowers in and around the well that she watered almost daily. She tended to it very nicely.
Or she helped decomposition.
Yeah. But like you said, if people are thinking, oh, this is the last thing that Jimmy Don did for her, look how well she's taking care of it.
Yep.
Little did they know that he was right underneath of it. Once the body was concealed, Betty Lou then called police to report Jimmy Don missing. So they got them all buried and then she called.
Did she plant the flowers before she called?
I don't think so. But when they came over, they wouldn't have looked in there. Why?
Because who digs a 6-foot hole underneath an ornamental wishing well?
They probably didn't even look underneath it. They probably didn't even look into it.
It's not like you need a foundation for it.
No.
The ground would have been disturbed.
It's true. But she probably just said, I'm going to plant flowers in there. And she planted it all around. It was wild to me. But police were not thinking foul play at the time. They thought he fell off his boat. It looked like it made sense.
She had attempted to murder 2 other people prior to this.
That's true. The day after burying her husband, Betty Lou enlisted her son's help once again. She gathered some of Jimmy's heart medication and scattered it in Jimmy's boat, along with his fishing license. Betty Lou had Robbie take the propeller off of Jimmy Don's boat, and together they abandoned it in the lake. When Betty Lou reported Jimmy Don missing, she told the police that Jimmy Don had gone fishing and never returned home. She also told police that Jimmy Don was having boat trouble leading up to this day, essentially setting the stage and planting the idea that Jimmy Don had fallen victim to a terrible mishap.
Oh, can you just see her acting all concerned about, oh, he went out on the boat and he's been having trouble with it. I'm so concerned about where he is.
Yes. And they had no reason to believe otherwise. Like I said, I don't think domestic violence was a big issue with this relationship. And this is a fire captain. They're not thinking that there's anything awry. They know him personally. Because otherwise, like, you might know, like, oh, yeah, he's got a crazy wife, right? Mm-hmm. So
I'm thinking to myself, at the fire hall, they would know he had a crazy wife.
That's what I mean. Yeah. And nobody was really thinking that. So that's why I don't really believe when she says, like, he was abusive. And her daughter says he wasn't.
Okay.
So I really don't think that he was. In court, Robbie said he stayed quiet for so long to try and protect his mother. However, to protect himself, he did testify against her in court. Robbie said that he had only told one person during the 2 years of silence, his ex-common-law partner, who also didn't tell anyone. He finally told the truth because it was weighing heavy on his conscience. So when they approached him, he just let it all out.
He had obviously been thinking about it a lot then.
It had been weighing on him a lot. I'm honestly so shocked that they didn't get caught right away. Not that the police didn't figure it out right away, but that no one saw them do these things. They buried him in the front yard and disposed of his boat. How did no one see anything? Betty Lou must have been a good actress, because when the police did find his boat 6 days later, she had to go to the marina to identify his boat and the contents inside of it. And no one found her suspicious. So like you said, she was a good actress. After Robbie's confession, Betty Lou was apprehended by the Mansfield Police Department and taken to the Henderson County Jail on June 8, 1985. Unsurprisingly, a warrant was immediately issued and Betty Lou's property was thoroughly searched. Authorities dug up the wishing well and found the decomposed body of Jimmy Don Beats. However, that is not all they found. To everyone's surprise, a second body was found in the yard.
What? In the same wishing well?
No, in the backyard.
Like, how big is this wishing well?
No, it's not. Both bodies were transported to the Dallas Forensic Science Laboratory, where it was confirmed that Jimmy Don was buried in the well, and it was discovered that the other person buried in the yard was none other than Betty Lou's 4th husband, who had supposedly taken off, Doyle Wayne Barker.
Had she lived in this one place the whole time?
Well, she had lived in here with Wayne as well as Jimmy Don. Doyle Wayne Barker went by Wayne, so that is what I will call him moving forward.
He never took off in the first place.
He didn't. His remains were found buried underneath a storage shed in the backyard. So they were really searching.
What led them to the storage shed? Had her son helped her with that murder as well?
No, I think they were just doing such a thorough search that they found him back there. They just started digging everything up. Like you said, maybe they looked into her past. Oh, you had 2 attempted murders? Let's just see what else we can find out here.
And the next husband went missing?
Well, had taken off.
Right.
Both husbands had been shot in the head with a .38 caliber handgun. Experts could not say with 100% certainty that both men were killed with the exact same gun, but they were fairly certain. Wayne was shot 3 times and Jimmy Don 2. And here is a fun fact. A .38 caliber gun had already been seized by the police from the Beetz's residence during an incident after the murders. Police just didn't know at the time that it wasn't just any gun, that it was, in fact, a murder weapon.
Why had they seized it?
It just said an unrelated incident.
Okay.
So I'm not sure. I couldn't find any police reports on that. Although not proven, it is highly believed that both men were killed with this gun. Robbie was asked what he knew about Wayne's death, but he did not live with his mother when she was married to Wayne, and he had only met him once, so he honestly had no idea. That being said, Betty Lou did have a child who knew exactly what had happened to her mother's fourth husband, her adult daughter, Shirley Stegner. Both Robbie and Shirley testified against their mother during her trial, and both admitted to helping dispose of the bodies.
Oh.
So it was Shirley who had helped her with Wayne.
Who was the next child going to help her dispose of the next husband?
Yeah, you're probably right. Betty Lou's trial for Jimmy Don's murder began on July 11th, 1985, in the 173rd District Court of Henderson County. Betty Lou pleaded not guilty of the charge of murder for remuneration and the promise of remuneration, and actually blamed her children for both murders.
What?
She totally tried to throw them under the bus and said that it was her kids who killed her husbands, and basically that explained why they knew so much about it.
What was their motive? They were jealous of their mother's relationship with these men?
I don't know, but she was like, it wasn't me, it was my kids, which I think is such a weasel of a dirtbag to throw your kids under the bus when you finally get caught.
Yeah, that's crazy.
Yeah, that blew my mind. Thankfully, Robbie and Shirley were able to fill in the blanks. Without them, both of these murders would have more than likely gone unsolved. So let's dig deeper into what happened regarding both deaths. Shirley said that her mother had contacted her on August 6th, the night that Jimmy Don went missing. Shirley was an adult and was not living with her mother. She had since been married and moved out. Betty Lou called and told Shirley that she needed to come to her house right away. Shirley asked her mother if, quote, she had done what we had talked about before. Apparently, Betty Lou had told Shirley that she was going to kill Jimmy. According to Shirley, Betty Lou's plan was to murder her husband and then get her son, Robbie, to help put Jimmy's body in his boat, take him out to the middle of the lake, and throw his body overboard. They would then abandon the boat so everyone would think he had drowned.
So dumping them in the wishing well wasn't the original plan?
Not originally, but I think she ended up switching to that. And maybe this is why, because I was thinking, what method was she going to kill him that would pass for a drowning? Because a gunshot wound to the head was not going to pull that plot off.
Maybe she was hoping that they would never find him on the bottom of the lake?
Maybe. So for whatever reason, she went with the wishing well. Shirley did end up rushing over to her mother's house. But when she got there, Betty Lou told her that everything was already taken care of and that she could go back home. And so she did. Because at this point, Betty Lou and Robbie had already buried Jimmy Don in the wishing well. Several weeks later, Shirley went to see her mom and was informed that, quote, her and my brother Robbie had buried Jimmy Don Beetz in the wishing well. So a few weeks later, she became aware of the situation. Shirley didn't know as much about Jimmy Don's death as her brother did, but she knew a lot more about Doyle Wayne Barker's demise at the hands of her mother.
Because she had helped bury him underneath the shed.
Yes, and we're going to go into what happened with that. Betty Lou's defense team tried to have any testimony of Wayne's death excluded from her court proceedings regarding Jimmy Don. The judge overruled this motion and said the testimony could be presented.
Because she hadn't been yet convicted of that murder?
Right.
Okay.
She was charged with both and was getting tried for Jimmy Don's first. And so, of course, the prosecution's like, well, we need to have this included, the testimony of the first murder.
But the defense was probably arguing that you couldn't bring in evidence that wasn't a proven conviction.
Exactly. But the judge did allow it. I'm going to read the summary of this testimony from Betty Lou's 1987 Court of Criminal Appeals of Texas court document. I was able to find so many appeal documents for this case, which was great. Just I felt like it was better summarized than I could have put it into my own words. The summary reads, quote, in the presence of the jury, Shirley testified that in October 1981, almost 2 years before Beetz disappeared, when her mother and Barker were married and living together, while she and her mother were, quote-unquote, sitting around a campfire, her mother told her that, quote, she was going to kill Doyle Wayne Barker because, quote, she couldn't put up with any more of him beating her and that she didn't want him around anymore. Her mother also told her that the trailer, meaning their house, was in his name, and she was just a co-signer on it, and that if they were to get a divorce, that he would end up with the trailer. Approximately 3 or 4 days later, at Shirley's residence, Shirley and her mother had another conversation, during which her mother told her that, quote, it was all over with and she had done what she intended to do. She told Shirley that she waited until Barker went to sleep, and then she got the gun and covered it with a pillow and pulled the trigger. And when she pulled the trigger, the pillow interfered with the firing pin. So she hesitated for a minute, afraid that Wayne was going to wake up. And she cocked the gun again and fired and shot him in the head. Thereafter, Shirley assisted her mother in disposing of Barker's body. Quote, we drug him from the trailer outside to the back and put him in the hole that had already been dug in order to build a barbecue pit. Shirley further testified that, quote, the next day, she and her mother went and bought some cinder blocks and built a patio over the hole in which Barker's body had been placed. Subsequently, a large storage shed replaced the patio. That was the summary of her testimony. This meant that, again, it seems like Wayne had unknowingly dug his own grave, thinking they were going to put in a barbecue pit.
I was just going to ask that.
Yes.
She made him dig his own grave, too.
Yeah, just like in Jimmy Don's case. And this bothers me. It speaks to so much calculation. What is even going through her mind watching these men dig their own graves?
Was she sitting back with that evil laughter like, hee hee hee?
Probably. In my mind, she was. It's just so sinister.
It is.
I watched an episode of Evil Lives Here titled Mama Made Me Help. It's season 8, episode 4. It aired in 2020. I had to pay like $1.60 to watch it, but it was well worth it. This was one of the only things I could find to watch on this case. This episode was basically an interview with Shirley, who now goes by Shirley Fergola. This interview took place over 35 years after the fact, and it was honestly heartbreaking to see how traumatized Shirley still is over her mother. I'm going to share some of the things that I learned by watching this, because these things are not in the court documents.
Well, she would have been traumatized even longer than her brother, hiding that secret for longer.
Yes. From what I could gather, Betty Lou's first 5 children were from her first marriage to Robert, including her daughter, Shirley. Betty Lou started out as a good and loving mother. Shirley remembers her mom taking time to teach her how to cook. So speaking about the first husband, when Betty Lou and Robert divorced, they didn't talk to the kids about it. Shirley said that one day her dad was there, and then suddenly he wasn't. And this was extremely confusing for the children.
How old would they have been at the time? Because you said they were married for 18 years.
Yeah, so at this time, Shirley was around age 10. To make matters worse, Betty Lou would take Shirley with her to essentially stalk Robert. Although as a young girl of around 10 or 11, Shirley didn't know that they were stalking her dad. Betty Lou would say, come with me, we need to go pick up your dad. And Shirley would get all excited. But then they would just sit in the car for hours spying on him, and then they would drive back home without him. Shirley said this really messed with her emotions.
Yeah, no kidding. So she's probably thinking that her dad doesn't want to come with them.
Right.
Or have anything to do with her.
Her mom wouldn't let her get out of the car. No, we're just going to wait here. She can see her dad, but he doesn't ever come home with them.
That would be difficult for a child.
It would.
Especially when the situation hasn't been explained.
Right. Just like, oh, come on, let's go get your dad. So she's like, yes, dad's coming home. And then she was too young to really process what actually was happening.
And was Betty Lou abusive towards her children?
She was. She just so happened to leave that out, but Shirley fills us in. It was at this time that Shirley noticed this change in her mother. All of a sudden, Betty Lou began dressing provocatively and would have men at the house 2 to 3 times each week. Eventually, Betty Lou stopped bringing the guys home and would go to them. Shirley said that her mom would buy them some groceries and leave them some cash and then take off with different men, sometimes for a week or two, leaving them home all alone. Shirley said her mother used these men to help her support her 5 children. And I'm not sure exactly what that meant.
It's just so sad because she was in that position where she had to be the caregiver for her younger siblings, and yet she's doing this to her children.
Exactly. Which I do talk about in here because there is some parallels in how she treated Shirley and how her life was. And when she says that these men helped to support her family, I don't know if they were just giving her money, if she was exchanging services for money. I don't really know. Shirley, though, was heartbroken when she learned that her mother was convicted of a misdemeanor for public lewdness around this same time. Betty Lou had been working at a joint in Texas called Charlie's Angels Bar. She was there on her night off to, quote-unquote, audition. In court, Betty Lou said, quote, "Well, it's a topless place, but I wasn't topless," and left it at that. Shirley said that when her mother was auditioning, her pasty fell off, and she let a customer help her put it back on. It just so happened that there was a vice cop in the establishment who witnessed this and charged her. Apparently, you can look, but you can't touch. She got in trouble for letting the guy touch by helping put the pasty back on. Promiscuity wasn't the only way in which Betty Lou changed after her first divorce. Shirley said that she saw her mother transform. She no longer took care of and nurtured the kids in the way that they needed. Betty Lou started to give them whoopins, as she called them. She would essentially beat the kids, even slapping them across their faces with belts. Shirley said that her father, Robert, never laid a hand on her. With five kids to feed, Betty Lou worked two jobs. Ironically, she left Shirley to cook for everyone and do the chores to keep the house clean. Exactly what happened to her at around the same age, when her mother went to the hospital. And like I said, interestingly, this won't be the only parallel that we will see between Betty Lou and her daughter, Shirley. Shirley also shed more light on Betty Lou's marriage with Billy. He's the one that she shot and survived. Shirley corroborated Betty Lou's claims that Billy was abusive towards her. Shirley remembers seeing Billy throw her mother around and beat on her. Many times her mother was left black and blue with cuts on her body and face. After a particularly bad beating, Betty Lou called Shirley, who was only 11 at the time, into her room. Betty Lou explained to her daughter that the next time Billy got out of hand, Betty Lou would call for her help. She then instructed Shirley that when this happened, Shirley needed to get the gun from Betty Lou's purse and shoot Billy.
She tried to make her daughter do it?
Yeah, she was 11. So she called her into her room. "Look what he did to me. Next time this happens, I'm going to call for your help and you need to shoot him.
You need to be the protector."
Yes.
This child.
Yes, this is what she's putting on her at 11, who's already taking care of the kids and the cooking in the house.
Because Betty Lou is the victim.
Yes. And I can't even imagine what that would do to an 11-year-old child, feeling like, oh, I have to help my mom. But how terrifying this would be for her. Sure enough, that same night, Betty Lou called for Shirley to help her. Shirley rushed into the room and pulled the gun out of her mother's purse and aimed it at her stepfather, Billy. Shirley remembers a lot of screaming and then her older brother, Beau, coming to the rescue. He stormed into the room and took the gun from Shirley. All this time, Betty Lou was just watching, waiting, and I think hoping her daughter would just pull the trigger, wanting her to do her dirty work.
A dirtbag thing to do.
Yes. Who does this to an 11-year-old?
Your child.
Yes.
Did she do it because she thought that Shirley could get away with it?
Probably. I never really thought of that, but she probably did, thinking, oh, she won't go to jail. She was protecting me. Mm-hmm. And Betty Lou, I'm sure, would have lied and said, oh, I didn't tell her to do this. She just saw how bad it was.
She sounds like quite the conniving planner.
Very manipulative. Later in the interview, Shirley speaks about the hard realization it was when she realized that her mother never really cared about her. And after hearing about her childhood, I think she's sadly right. As I mentioned, Betty Lou did end up shooting Billy herself. They would be on again and off again even after that shooting. Shirley said she remembers one night being awoken from bed by the sound of gunfire. She jumped up and ran to her window because it sounded like it came from outside. She saw Billy laying on the ground and could hear him moaning in pain. Shirley ran downstairs to her mother, and all her mother told her was to go back to bed, and so she listened. So she remembers the night that Billy got shot. Shirley left her chaotic, abusive home at the first chance she could, again mirroring her mother's footsteps. At age 14, Shirley moved out to marry a boy who had asked her. She said she was already having to live like an adult, so she might as well be one.
Sadly true.
And Betty Lou, even though this is what she had done, she was irate when she learned of her daughter's decision. She belittled her and told her no one would ever love her. She also tried to hurt her by telling her that Robert wasn't even her father, that Billy was. But this wasn't true.
She's just trying to inflict pain. She's become the bully?
Yeah. To her children. Which is disgusting. When Betty Lou married her third husband, Ronnie, Shirley recalled a time when she went to their house in Rockwall, Texas, to see her mom. Her mom wasn't home, so she sat at the table and was talking with her stepdad. He offered to give her a ride to work. Betty Lou came home and saw the two of them sitting at the table together eating breakfast.
She gets jealous.
She does. She lost it and immediately accused the two of having an affair. She called her daughter vile names and again told her how worthless she was. During this interview, Shirley gives more detail on what happened regarding the murder of Doyle Wayne Barker. Again, she said that Wayne would beat her mother. She said he was mean, he was a drunk, and he was a womanizer. One day, Betty Lou showed Shirley pictures of some of her injuries at the hands of her fourth husband. He had even broken two bones in her arm. Betty Lou told Shirley that she had decided to kill Wayne. She asked Shirley to babysit her younger brother for the weekend so that he would be out of the house when she did it. Shirley said that she felt sick to her stomach and was in denial, but she took her little brother. So again, she's premeditating this.
Mm-hmm.
The next day, when Shirley woke up, her mother was inside her home on her couch. Betty Lou told her that it was done and instructed her to meet her at her house at midnight.
And why wouldn't you go? Because she's just murdered somebody.
Exactly.
You would fear for your own life.
And that's what Shirley said. She said she was terrified. She said she was worried about what her mother would do to her if she didn't show up. And so she did. When she got to her mother's house in the middle of the night, her mother showed her what she had done. Betty Lou, after killing her husband, wrapped his body up in a sheet and then in plastic. She then stuffed his body inside of a blue sleeping bag. Over 3 decades later, Shirley said she is still haunted by the sound that Wayne's head made as it hit each step as they drug him down the stairs.
Oh, that's creepy.
It still haunts her. Betty Lou just told Shirley that Wayne got what was coming to him.
Nobody deserves that.
The two drug Wayne out into the yard and buried him. Shirley felt sick and got blisters from the shovel. As the sun began to rise, Betty Lou sent her daughter home and said that she would finish the rest. After this, Shirley tried her best to just block out the memory of what happened. She was terrified. When asked about Jimmy Dawn, Betty Lou's fifth husband and second murder victim, Shirley said that Jimmy Dawn was probably the nicest person she ever met. And this is why I question the abuse allegation. She said he was kind, generous, and soft-spoken. From what she could see, Jimmy Dawn was good to her mother. Betty Lou insisted that there are lots of different ways to abuse someone and told her daughter that she was going to kill Jimmy Dawn. When Jimmy Dawn went missing, Shirley confronted her mother about it and said that she still has tremendous guilt over not doing anything to stop it. Part of her didn't think it would happen. These secrets ate Shirley up inside, and so one night, after getting drunk with her younger sister and her younger sister's husband, Shirley spilled the beans. She told them everything. I just can't imagine how this would have been tormenting her.
Good for her for finally doing it, though.
Yeah, she just needed some liquid courage to do it. It was her sister and brother-in-law who went home and called in the tip to Crime Stoppers. They were the reliable source.
Okay.
So Shirley finally tells a younger sibling, and she's like, yeah, no, I'm going to go to the police. Like, this isn't okay.
I thought it was Shirley that went to the Crime Stoppers.
No. Shirley was too terrified to turn on her mom, but she did end up telling her little sister. When police apprehended Betty Lou, she blamed Shirley and Robbie. And so Shirley said she was promptly arrested as well. Again, Shirley realized that her mother was willing to pass the blame and let her daughter rot in prison for the rest of her life at the age of 29, and this was a hard pill to swallow. Shirley loves her mother, but spent most of her life terrified of her. She saw her mother years later and said that her mother showed no remorse or accountability for her actions, not even a sorry for trying to pin the murders on her and her brother.
That bond that between parent and child, when there's abuse that goes on, so fascinating. We've covered now several cases about it, and understanding how a child can still love their abusive parent is so bewildering, but you can see how it happens.
Oh, yeah. And watching this documentary with Shirley, she's physically traumatized. You would think it happened yesterday as she's talking about this, but she starts out right at the beginning. I love my mom, but she's the person I'm most scared of in the whole world, kind of a thing.
Gotta be such a messed up relationship.
Oh, yeah. Totally one-sided. And she knows that her mom doesn't care about her, wasn't even going to apologize. Oh, sorry, I almost sent you to jail for your whole life. Just acting like it didn't even happen. And just woe is me. Because this was later when she had visited her in prison.
It sounds like how Rosemary West treated her children.
Yes.
Just always playing the victim and wanting their sympathy.
True. And using that to manipulate them. Looking back, Shirley sees that her mother was mentally unwell and does feel regret and guilt over not being able to help her, which I just thought was sad.
That she's having to take on one more thing.
Yes. It's not your fault. This documentary was clearly extremely difficult for Shirley to do. She had to stop many times throughout it to compose herself. But she said that she wanted to do it to help anyone who watches it to know that they can get through anything in life. And I just thought, what a queen, because this wouldn't have been easy to talk about. Shirley had to spend a month in jail with her mother until her name was cleared and she was released. And let's just say Betty Lou was not very maternal towards her during this time. She's honestly such a dirtbag. Was not good. During the trial, the prosecution argued that Betty Lou had killed her husband for financial gain. With Wayne, she got to keep the trailer, but with Jimmy Don, she stood to cash in on some moolah from his death.
Life insurance and a pension?
Exactly. Betty Lou was going to inherit $86,000 from a life insurance policy on Jimmy Don with the city of Dallas, since he was his city employee. Today, that is over $260,000 US and over $350,000 Canadian. Betty Lou was also just about to start collecting pension benefits for her dead husband. Her application had just been approved. She was about to receive a lump sum of $15,852.59 and then a monthly benefit of $790.42 for the rest of her life or until she remarried. Today, that lump sum would have been over $48,000 US and over $65,000 Canadian, and her monthly pension check would be over $2,500 US and over $3,200 Canadian.
So a decent enough living.
Definitely. Jimmy Don had just been deemed deceased legally by the courts 3 months before his remains were found, and that is how she was just going to start cashing this in. The approval of these funds being sent to Betty Lou were quickly revoked when the board members heard about the murder charge. Betty Lou had also sold Jimmy Don's boat used as a ploy to cover up his murder and collected the money a year after his death. She forged his signature on the bill of sale to do so.
It was probably because she just had so many bad memories about the boat that he died on.
Right? I kept it for a whole year, but it's just too painful to look at now. On top of this, Betty Lou had collected money from a different life insurance outside of Jimmy Don's work. She had collected $23,428 for his death, as well as an additional $20,000 because his death was ruled accidental. This was almost $133,000 US today, and close to $180,000 Canadian. So this wasn't a bad inheritance when you add it all up. If I mathed correctly, it totaled almost $600,000 Canadian today, plus her $3,200 every month on top of that.
That's a good paycheck.
Definitely. At the time of the trial, Shirley testified that she didn't think her mother killed Jimmy Don for financial gain, but in the documentary years later, she questions if this maybe was her motivating factor.
I bet you at the trial she didn't have all of the financial figures.
No, and she had seen her mother going through this cycle with all these different men, so why would Jimmy Don be different?
Do you think the money was just a convenient bonus afterwards?
I don't know, to be honest, because I really don't feel that Jimmy Don was abusive to her. I think Wayne she killed because he was abusive, and she wanted to leave him, but knew he would get to keep the trailer. So I think for her, it was like, it's easier to just get rid of him. She obviously was not shy about inflicting pain or trying to kill somebody.
Right. But then I wonder with Jimmy Don, she already had this pattern that relationships didn't last for very much longer than a year. And she was already past that. So maybe she was just bored with him.
Could be.
She knew how to get rid of them.
Yeah.
They say it becomes easier to kill after the first one.
And she had gone multiple years now with nobody knowing what had happened to Wayne.
Mm-hmm.
It was a good 2 years that he was in her backyard.
So now she's feeling quite emboldened.
Yes.
I think the money had something to do with it.
I think it had to have.
It would have been incentive anyway.
Maybe it was the icing on the cake. Maybe not the complete motivating factor.
She was just getting bored of him because there's no spice anymore?
I don't know. She said, well, there's different ways to be abusive. I think in her mind, she just decided I'm a victim and looking for ways that he's being bad to her. And so, like she had said to Shirley when they were getting rid of Wayne, well, he got what was coming to him. I think she was maybe just had that mentality. It was so twisted that Jimmy Don is abusive too, in whatever way that she felt that he was. And he has this coming and I might as well benefit from it.
But she justified it.
I think so.
And kind of made up her own reality.
I think so. It's hard to say because she never comes clean. She just stays a dirtbag.
And that's pretty obvious with all the appeals she filed.
Oh, yeah. And by then she's like this grandma figure and she's crying and woe is me. She's crying about, oh, how they have to strip search me all the time in prison. Instead of saying this is a consequence of my action of actually taking the life of two men that I have to be strip searched, it's, well, I'm already a victim and now you're continuing to victimize me. The defense argued that there was no real evidence to convict Betty Lou of the crime, that it was her children. That's the story they were sticking to.
They actually tried to sell that?
Yeah. And that's how they knew all this information.
Okay.
On October 11th, 1985, Betty Lou was found guilty for the murder of her husband, Jimmy Don Beats. The jury didn't buy it. 3 days later, she was sentenced to death and sent to Texas Department of Correction in the Mountain View Unit. Because she was given the death sentence for Jimmy Don, she was only ever charged with the death of Doyle Wayne Barker. The courts decided it didn't matter if she was convicted of his death since she was going to be executed.
Oh, and you hate that.
I do.
I understand.
Yeah, financially it makes sense, but it doesn't usually sit well with me. Betty Lou scrambled to save her life with appeal after appeal. Her claims of self-defense and abuse allegations came out after the trial. She couldn't use it as a defense when she was trying to pin it on her kids. Her first and automatic appeal to the Texas Court of Criminal Appeals overturned her conviction, stating that insurance and pension benefits were not the same as remuneration. However, upon review, the original sentence was reinstated. Betty Lou spent 10 years trying to appeal her case, even going to the Supreme Court of the United States. Grasping at any hope that she could, Betty Lou even petitioned Texas Governor George W. Bush just a year before he became president to stay her execution, but to no avail. Bush did not believe that Betty Lou had killed Jimmy Don in self-defense, and she hadn't. It was clearly premeditated, as was the death of Wayne. Her execution date was finally set for February 24th, 2000. Betty Lou denied any request for a final meal, and when asked if she had any final words, with the viewing room filled with loved ones of the men she had killed, she denied the opportunity to say anything. At 6:18 p.m., Betty Lou Beats, at the age of 62, was put to death by lethal injection at the state prison in Huntsville, Texas. Betty Lou was cremated, and her ashes were scattered on top of her mother's grave. Her execution came down to the wire. The U.S. Supreme Court declined to intervene only an hour before her execution, and Governor Bush declined a grant to stay just minutes after that. This waiting time must have been tense for Betty Lou. A prison spokesman said that during this time of waiting, Betty Lou wrote letters, read her Bible, and visited with the prison chaplain in a holding cell near the death chamber. Earlier that day, Betty Lou's attorney told CNN about his client, quote, "She's very scared. She doesn't want to be strapped down to that gurney all alone." Betty Lou was the fourth woman executed in the United States since capital punishment was reinstated in 1976, and the second woman executed in the state of Texas in that same time period. Some people refer to Betty Lou as the grandma killer because at the time of her death, she had multiple grandchildren and great-grandchildren. Many feel like Betty Lou was a victim of abuse and should never have been executed. I agree that she had been abused throughout her entire life, but I also feel like she murdered Jimmy Don Beats in cold blood. In a dramatic plea before her death, pictures of Betty Lou, badly beaten, were released with the words, quote, "What my husband started, Texas will finish." Her actual quote for this was, quote, "My time is running out, and the state of Texas will pick up where my husband left off. While the Texas law enforcement out there did nothing to help me, it is now legal for them to finish the job."
A bold statement.
Yeah. And the picture was her showing, it looked like strangle marks under her chin and neck. Human rights experts from the UN protested that the prolonged abuse that Betty Lou suffered had an effect on her state of mind and actions. They also asked George Bush to grant her a stay of execution. Bush had actually received well over 2,000 phone calls and letters in total requesting his help in Betty Lou's case. Bree Buchanan of the Texas Council on Family Violence stated, quote, Her long history of abuse, beginning as a child and continuing throughout adulthood, it certainly sounded like she suffered from battered woman syndrome and post-traumatic stress disorder. Betty Lou was quoted saying, quote, "I really believe that to kill me is to tell every battered woman and child, every abused woman and child, that there is not a chance, that there is no end but death, that we can't fight back." Betty spoke about how in her family, there were now 5 generations of abuse towards women and it needed to stop. And I will just say that Doyle Wayne Barker was 41 years old at the time of his murder. I definitely believe that he was horrendous to Betty Lou, but I'm not sure I believe that Jimmy Don Beetz, who was 46, was. Jimmy Don was described as a kind man, a U.S. war veteran who had served in Korea. These 2 men, Betty, also could not fight back. About Betty Lou's execution, Jimmy Don's son said, quote, "I ask that God be with her family. Now she knows what we feel like." And that is the controversial case of Texas's Black Widow, who tried to kill 2 of her husbands, stalked another one, and was ultimately executed for killing 2 of her other husbands. The tumultuous dirtbag with a fantastic name, Betty Lou Beetz.
Wow, Christy.
She stood up to her name for me.
But I can see why it would be so controversial.
It did spur a lot of debate in the media afterwards if she should have been executed or not. And there was a lot of people that felt very strongly that she shouldn't have been.
It just goes to show how much impact family violence has on our society as a whole when it's not dealt with.
Oh, absolutely. And it's just really sad that that cycle can continue, like Betty Lou said, for 5 generations.
It is really sad when the cycle continues. And unfortunately, that's what we see with so many of the dirtbags we cover.
True. And be nice to your kids, because you could raise a murderer if you're not.
But sometimes, doesn't matter how you raise them.
That is true, and we've seen that before as well. And with that being said, tune in next week when Melissa will bring us another case.
With another dirtbag.
Until then.
See ya.
Bye. Testing, testing.
Oh, people.
We're always like, it's been a day. It's already been a day. Were you eating too fast? Are we trying to, were you talking?
Or just, nope. I just.
You're just eating impaired.
forgot that you shouldn't breathe as you were trying to swallow.
But it's actually like painful.
Eating fast.
I know. We're chewing my food better. Like. We can't even feed ourselves. We don't even know how to eat properly. This woman's wild. In the presence of the jury and Shirley, I'm always like looking ahead. In our promo trailer where you're like, she was off the wall crazy. I'm like, this is this lady.
And then with Jimmy Dean.
Jimmy Don.
Oh, sorry. And then Jimmy Dean. But then with
Jimmy Don.
Jimmy Don.
I need to stop talking with my hands.
You've gotten into this one today. You've been talking with your hands lots.
I have. 3 days. Oh, that's my. I thought it was a spider. This part of my bracelet like popped out all of a sudden. I was like, whoa, what's on my hand?
Hey, we're live, pal, and we'd love for you to come check out our podcast, Tales from the Estate. Each week, we talk about our top 5 favorite somethings. My beautiful wife, Caitlin, likes to share all sorts of random facts.
Yeah. Did you know that cows have accents?
We did now. But we also review all sorts of snacks and other great things. And so if you love everything random, I think you'd enjoy Tales from the Estate. So come check us out.
Yeah.
Okay, thanks. Bye.
Come on a journey like no other, where you will discover many roads that will lead you to a happier, healthier, and more stress-free life. And the beauty is, you don't need any vacation time for this adventure. The journey will come to you. Join Avery Rich on your very own journey into yoga. Along the way, she will demystify yoga poses and guide you into a yoga posture or short sequence all in less than 15 minutes. You have nothing to lose but stress. The Journey into Yoga podcast. It's not for people who like yoga. It's for people who don't like yoga. Follow or subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Amazon Music, or at averyrich.com.
Another Sound Off Media Company podcast.